Have you heard of the little church that could? Join Pastor Bob Enyart at Denver Bible Church for Sunday school at 9:30 a.m., worship service from 10:50 until noon, and our Sunday evening Bible study at 6 p.m. Located at Two Roads School at 7180 Oak Street in Arvada, Colorado. Join us on Sundays as we study the meat of the Word of God, to worship our awesome Creator and to equip the saints for the service of the Lord.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 at DU Law School, there will be, and this is, I think, the second time in state history that there will be oral arguments in front of an appeal court panel of judges in a case that was started by the defendants, pro se defendants, Ken Scott and Cliff Powell. And Ken Scott was on the show on Thursday. We had a great interview. He won in federal court against the Obama administration and Eric Holder. Now this is a separate case, free speech for Christians, and there will be about 100, 150 law students in attendance. This is a big deal. If you want to go, if you want reserved seating, please call us here at Bob Enyart Live, 1-800-8-ENYART. 1-800-836-9278. Let me know how many people, how many seats, and we will make an effort to get you reserve seating so you don't have to sit in overflow. But it's going to be great. I plan to be there with our kids. All right, now, you might know the name Russ Haas, H-A-A-S, because Russ has been a conservative Christian activist in Colorado for many years, staunch supporter of personhood. In fact, he was the proponent of Amendment 61 in 2010, the effort of that was to limit government borrowing. And Russ is a personal friend, and he's an expert in history. He's one of the most fascinating people I know, and it's an honor to have Russ Haas in studio. Russ, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Thank you.
So, Russ, I was hoping that you and I could talk, the way we talk if we meet for coffee or something, about history and Christianity and what we're up against in the world we live in. So I thought perhaps we could start with a relatively recent event of 9/11, when America was attacked. Could you lead us through your thoughts on what happened there?
Well, 9/11 was a significant date to us, but it's a very significant date in the Islamic or Muslim world. Hmm. Islam had three major military defeats in a period of about 200 years. So 9/11 probably is a revenge for them. Hmm. The first of all was the failure or the defeat in the siege of Malta, where the Turks put 43,000 men on the island, and the defenders had 8,000, of which 700 were knights. They put them up on board in May. They took them off in September. Only 11,000 were left.
Oh, wow.
The fortress of Malta remained unbeaten, and September 11 was the last day of that last full day of that siege.
Wow. Now, the New Testament, of course, speaks of Paul's stop on the island of Malta. It's in the Mediterranean, for people who are tuning in. The Turks, I've spent 3 weeks in Turkey. You've traveled a lot in your life, right?
Right. I've probably been in Turkey a good six times.
Six times to Turkey.
Yeah.
When you go to Turkey, the nationalism is intense. It's a secular Islamic government. That's, I think, an accurate description.
Yeah.
So you went back a couple hundred years to the Battle of Malta, and the Muslims were defeated.
Right. Then you move into the next century, and you have the Second Siege of Vienna in 1687. And the last full day of that siege was September 11th.
Oh, wow.
And Bob, as being of Dutch descent, do you know how far the raiding parties came out from Vienna?
Well, no, I don't. And I am partly Dutch, German, you're right, English, and half Italian. But go ahead.
Yeah, the raiding parties, the scouting parties, reached the Dutch border.
Oh.
And this today is a full day's train ride from Vienna, and I've taken it. Mm. So this was another tipping point. Does Europe go to Islam, or does it remain Christian? Mm. 12 years later, in...
What, 1689?
1689. 8 years later, Zenta, in what's now Serbia, was the last major battle where the Turks were coming north. Prince Eugen, the Austrian general, defeated them. The peace treaty was signed the year later, 1698, and that completely freed present-day Hungary from Islam.
Mm. Muslims have, of course, a history going back more than 1,000 years, and there was a time when they had a significant empire, supremacy in a good chunk of the world. And, of course, with their belief system having a major impact on their ability to maintain any kind of equitable parity with the West. When we were in Turkey, Russ, we were told by our Turkish guide that many Muslims believed that machines were demonic, that they had evil spirits in them. And in Turkey, as in other countries, there was a concerted effort to resist any kind of modernization. And it was Ataturk in Turkey who made a significant impact, telling them to look to the West, look to the West. And so Turkey, more so than other Islamic countries, began to modernize, but they're still a couple few decades behind us.
Right. Well, Turkey had been on a losing streak, shall we say, since 1697, and had its empire in Europe rolled back and rolled back to the point where it was only in Europe around present-day Istanbul, formerly known as Constantinople. Mm. Ataturk said, we have to adopt the Western modes, means, knowledge, call it what you want, mm-hmm. if we're ever going to get out of this. Because after the peace treaty ending World War I, Turkey was carved up into colonies of France, of Britain. Armenia was split off in the northeast, and Italy.
Mm. What happened then with the islands? You know, the Greek Isles there?
Right.
You've been to some of them. We've been to some of them, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Patmos, of course, is where the Apostle John was exiled. Those islands today belong to which country?
All of the islands are Greek now.
They're Greek, and when you go there, some of them are so close to Turkey's shores, it's stunning that they're all Greek islands.
You're right. And there is a group of them called the Dodecanese, which stands for 12 islands, which were under Italian domination until the end of World War II. They picked them up in the late 1800s as the empire was collapsing and held them through World War I. Hmm. And again, when the war was over, then they reverted back to Greece.
Mm-hmm. And so that's another example of a real sore spot. There's so many particular situations that cause Muslims and Arabs in the Arab world to have a long simmering, not a dislike, but a hatred even, of the West and of Christianity. Our tour guide in Turkey, Bora, in fact, he's the most successful tour guide in the country. He said to us with a degree of pride that Ataturk taught their nation that women should be able to inherit property. And he was proud about that. And I mean, that's good. That's a good thing to be proud about. But we did point out to him, it was a Bob and Yurt live tour for 3 weeks. We had a full bus of people, had a wonderful time. And we loved Bora. But I pointed out to Bora that in the scriptures, in the books of Moses, which are 1,500 years before Christ, we read that Israel was told by God that women should be able to inherit property. So Ataturk got it right, but it was 3,500 years after this was common knowledge among the Jews and, of course, Christians. So we see that your worldview really can have a major impact on your success as a culture.
Well, to talk more on Turkey and old or ancient Christian history, where was the first nation that adopted Christianity as its official religion? But Armenia in the north and east and the east sections. Mm. Where did Rachel at the well?
Yeah.
That's in southern Turkey, a place called Haran. The nearest large city to it right now is called Urfa, which used to be Edessa. The Crusaders had Edessa as a fief. And if you want to go way back, supposedly the king of Edessa by the name of Abgar had a correspondence with Jesus Christ. In this supposed conversation, he's saying to Jesus, please come to my country where you will not be tormented and eventually killed.
So the unfolding of Christianity around the world, of course, that story in and of itself is so central to understanding world history. Before Christ, we were in Old Testament times, and Israel had a tremendous influence on the culture and the history and even alliances of nations going back in the Old Testament period. And in our sermon on Sunday morning at Denver Bible Church, I showed on an overhead projector, I showed three Chinese pictographs where the words for boat, devil, and tempter come right out of the early chapters of the book of Genesis, where the word for boat is a vessel, like a bowl, with the number eight in mouths, like eight mouths to feed in a vessel. That's their picture for boat. And we had a gal from Japan in the congregation, and she came up to me and said, those pictographs you showed from that are based on biblical truths, they're also in Japanese. We have about 2,000 such characters, and they're in the Japanese language also, which was fascinating. So, Russ, it seems like when we study the scriptures, the Judeo-Christian worldview, it enables us to better understand the history of the world.
All right. And since you brought up China, you know there's a Jewish community that goes way, way back in the, and it's located in the Southwest, still existent today?
No, I did not know that. Yeah. Wow.
And we think of China and opening to Christianity only when the Western explorers came around by sea. But twice before the year 1300, the Christians had come overland on the Silk Road to China, reached the Pacific, and both times when the Silk Road was closed.
The Silk Road, you're saying?
Right. The Silk Road was the trade route from China to Europe that went across Asia.
The south of the Black Sea, across northern Turkey.
Well, it had two different sections. Think of Tehran, Iran, and it went through there. Then it went to Herat in Afghanistan, and then north of the Pamir Mountains. And then when it got to China, it split and went around the desert that's in the far west of China, rejoined, and ended up at Xi'an, where you have the army that was found of terracotta figures buried by one of the old emperors.
Oh, yeah, right.
And there was a steel, looks like a great big tombstone or monument.
A steel like a rock that's engraved.
A pillar almost that's engraved. And it has a cross on it coming out of a lotus, and it commemorates the arrival of the Christian religion in China in the 600s.
Wow. The fact that we call Asia the East and we call Europe and then the New World the West sort of makes us wonder, well, where would the center be? And the center then would be what we call today the Middle East. And it's fascinating to me, Russ, that Japan, we call it the land of the rising sun. I mean, Japan means east. It means the rising sun. That's what it means, the name of the country. And so Japan is east. For people who live there, it's not east. It's where they live. But their country is called Japan, the east, the rising sun, from the perspective of the Middle East. And the history of the world seems to reinforce the Bible's teaching that Israel was God's promised land, that the Mesopotamian Valley, the spread of civilization after Noah and his family and the Tower of Babel and the distribution around the world, the world really does reinforce what we read in the pages of the Bible. So could we talk more on the spread of Christianity. I know that you and I have talked about Eastern Christianity, the Ukraine, and what happened early on when Islam was entering and receding from Europe. Could we talk more about some of that?
Well, you brought up the Ukraine and the spread of things. Early on, there was a Turkish tribe that lived in the area between the Black Sea, the Caspian, and the Caucasus Mountains. And this particular tribe was looking for a religion, shall we say, in the 600s, the 7th century. Do we choose Judaism? Do we choose Christianity? Do we choose Islam? And they took the middle way, and they adopted Judaism as their state religion. Upper classes mostly, but it did filter down to the lower class. They became very strong, and they concluded a military alliance with Constantinople, which was the center of Eastern Christianity. And this served two purposes. It kept the other Turkish tribes from invading the Middle East, present-day Turkey, Eastern Europe,
Syria.
And they kept the Vikings from coming down the Russian rivers and attacking Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. And this alliance held probably for 300 or 400 years. Then about the year, in the late 900s, almost the year 1000, the Ukrainians converted to Christianity, which we think, great, it's a wonderful thing. But then the Byzantine says, well, we don't need the ex-Turkish tribe anymore. We'll construct an alliance with the Ukrainians, which they did. And the Turkish tribe then fell to the Seljuk Turks. And that was the major hit that the Eastern Christians took in the century between 1000 and 1100.
When we have toured Turkey, we created a resource called the Bible Tour of Turkey. And what I noticed there, everybody notices, is that when you go to a museum, they have artifacts that are thousands of years old. And it's funny, living in Denver, you go to a museum here, you go to a museum where things are 100 years old, 130 years old. You go to New York City and museums have exhibits of things that are 300-400 years old. You go to England and museums have things that are 1,000 years old. Of course, I'm speaking in generalities. And you go to Greece and museums have things that are 2,000 years old. You go to Turkey and they have things that are 3,000 and 4,000 years old, actually like the oldest iron implements ever discovered, for example. And so we really do see a pattern of the development of civilization that is understandable to someone from a Judeo-Christian perspective.
Yeah, you brought up the discovery of iron, and that came out of Turkey with the Hittites. You know that name from the Bible because
yes.
David stole the wife of Uriah the Hittite.
Uriah the Hittite. In fact, there were skeptics who denied the existence of the Hittite Empire. And now if you go to Istanbul, in fact, the capital of Turkey is
Ankara.
There is the Hittite Museum. They don't call it the Hittite Museum there. It might come to me in a moment.
I think it's the Museum of Anatolian Civilizations.
That's exactly right. I don't know how you know these things. When I've talked to Russ Haas over the years, no matter what topic we get on in history, geography, Russ, you're just phenomenal, and I hope that comes across to the audience. But in that museum, you see the wealth and the sophistication and the extent of the Anatolian, the Hittite Empire. The Bible, when it addresses historical matters, it is reliable. And the skeptics have had egg on their face 100 times over, hundreds of times over, denying Pontius Pilate, denying just example after example. And it's exciting to travel the world and see that the Bible's perspective is the true perspective.
One more thing on the Hittites. We had Ramesses II, who was a pharaoh in the era of the Jewish people being in Egypt. And he was a great military expansionist. And if you go to his tomb, there is a frieze of his great defeat of the Hittites. I believe it was Carchemish in northern Syria near Antioch. The archaeologist who came up with this then went to Bayazkale, which is northeast of Ankara, and they found the Hittite version of it in the library there. And no, it wasn't a great win by the Egyptians. It was a draw. Because in Egypt, there was no loot that came or booty that came from this victory, which was totally strange.
Yeah, right. In fact, we have that. There's a book written by Emmanuel Velikovsky called Ages in Chaos. And I think his claims about planets have been completely falsified. But he was an expert in ancient history. He was a co-editor with Albert Einstein of a Jewish technical journal in Israel. A brilliant guy. And he wrote and showed how there are letters in the Bible between the king of Israel and Pharaoh. And when you study alongside an Egyptologist, you find in Egypt's ancient literature the corresponding letters back and forth, so that we actually have both sides of the correspondence still extant to this day. This is such a wonderful confirmation. In fact, the term Pharaoh, I found out when we went to the King Tut exhibit. We brought our kids. It was at the Denver Art Museum, the National Geographic's exhibit going around the world. And the first thing you learn when you went to that exhibit, it's still being shown in cities around the world, is that Pharaoh was not an Egyptian term. Pharaoh was a Hebrew term, and it was their Hebrew word for the king's palace in Egypt. And so the world, for the most part, the world refers to ancient Egyptian kings, not by the ancient Egyptian word for Pharaoh, but by the Bible's word for the king of Egypt, which is so exciting to me. The constant affirmation in the culture, the united culture of mankind, that the scriptures are God's word.
Well, don't just stop at Egyptians. If you go over the border one country east into present-day Iran or what was Persia then, we still have Bible references. If you go down south in Iran to what was biblical, the land of Elam, you'll get to a place where there was a royal capital called Susa. And if you look in the book of Daniel, you will see reference to standing in the palace at Elam looking at the river Ulai. If you go down to the present-day river there, you will find a small mosque complex which supposedly houses the tomb of the prophet Daniel.
Wow. These stories, like the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, they're really, historically, they're the trilogy that ends the history of the Old Testament. But there is so much in these books that we see today, and we contrast that with, say, Joseph Smith in his Book of Mormon, which you don't find archaeologists in the Americas using the Book of Mormon as an interpretive tool, because it was sheer fabrication. Whereas atheist historians and archaeologists, not only in the Middle East, but in parts of Asia and Europe, Northern Africa, they will look at the scriptures and they see that the things that are written about are confirmed by their modern discoveries. Things they're discovering today are reinforcing the biblical account.
Right. And if you go north, there's a present-day city in Iran called Hamadan. In the Greek era, it was called Ecbatana. And the locals there still have the tombs of Esther and Mordecai, which they revere, even though they are Muslim.
American Right to Life draws lessons on pro-life strategy from the Book of Esther. It's fascinating. There's an article there on incrementalism, AmericanRightToLife.org/incrementalism. And you see that Esther had to deal with a country that had adopted an unjust law. And how do you go about addressing that? And how do you go about trying to repeal this unjust law? It shouldn't be a law at all. Yet one of the books of the Bible, the entire book, is focused on that topic. So the scriptures deal with things that are actually real in history. We only have a couple minutes left, Russ. Has any of this discussion prompted some thoughts that you'd like to share before we're out of time?
Not thoughts to share, but two more things. We think most of the apostles went west into the Roman Empire. But again, they went east. And in northwest Iran, there is a pilgrimage site for the Armenians, which supposedly is on the site where Thaddeus Jude, the apostle, is buried. There's a great Armenian family or tribal gathering there every year in July, where the people come from all the surrounding countries. There's another place a little bit farther north on what used to be the border of the Soviet Union, now is the border of Azerbaijan, where Bartholomew worked. And supposedly Bartholomew is buried in southeast Turkey. However, that particular site was blown to bits by the Turks in 1975.
Wow. It's interesting that, and we are about out of time, maybe I could give a plug for one of our resources, our study on the book of Galatians that we offer, verse-by-verse study. We point out that the New Testament, even though it goes through to about the death of John the Apostle, he was in exile in Patmos, and so it goes about to 100 AD, about, yet it only records the missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul, which is so fascinating, because there's a lot of Christian history and tradition that the apostles were missionaries. But there seems to be a reason why the Bible only records the journeys of Paul, and that's a subject for another show. But Russ Haas, thank you for what you're doing with your gentle conservative activism, promoting the truth of Christianity and the personhood movement. You're a significant influence on people in Colorado. Thank you for all that, Russ. So what an honor to have Russ Haas in studio. If you are ever at a pro-life event, I saw Russ at the Jefferson County Republican Assembly. Go up to him, introduce yourself, and you'll really enjoy talking to him, as I do. May God bless you.
Now you can subscribe to Bob Enyart's monthly Bible study DVDs. These verse-by-verse Bible study videos are great for family Bible study or even starting your own neighborhood Bible study. Each month, you get 4 or 5 Bible study sessions on 2 DVDs. You can subscribe by calling 1-800-8-ENYART or online at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.